Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 283, titled The Mueller File. This is being recorded on March 18th of the year 2001. The title refers to former Gestapo chief Heinrich Mueller, whose escape and survival at the end of World War II is a matter of public record. However, that record has been largely obfuscated until very recently. We're going to be discussing the Heinrich Mueller file, and we're going to begin with an excerpt from Miscellaneous Archive Show M57, titled The Flight of the Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler, recorded on October 31st of 1993. First of all, note the secondary source from which this excerpt comes. It's called The Flight of the Wolf. That's an article by Gregory Douglas from The Military Advisor, subtitled The Publication for International Military Hobbyists. And that is from the Military Advisor's issue of winter of 1992 and 93, volume 4, number 1. And note the sources from which this information is taken: U.S. Counterintelligence Corps documents, other U.S. intelligence documents, these accessed from the National Archives, and in turn accessed by a journalist named Gita Sereny, who was working on this story for the London Times, and note the collaboration of many of the forensic aspects of these documents by the FBI. This is from Miscellaneous Archive Show M57, The Flight of the Wolf. There is, however, additional and very powerful support and refutation of the establishment view of Hitler's end, and it is to be found in official U.S. and British documents, most of which surfaced quietly in the early 1980s. These documents, which originate from diverse official sources, cover much of the post-war activities and employment of SS Gruppenführer Heinrich Mueller, former head of Amt IV of the RSHA, the Gestapo. The first series of papers uncovered were prepared in the Berlin headquarters of the U.S. Army's counterintelligence and concerned the use of former senior SS officers by American and British intelligence. The second find consisted of the microfilmed personal files of Mueller and contained extensive transcripts of Mueller interviews held in Switzerland in 1948 with representatives of the newly formed CIA. The CIC papers make specific reference to Hitler's departure from Berlin in April of 1945 and general references to his presence in Spain. The statements about Hitler's flight are not speculative but specific and state that Hitler fled Berlin. Another very clear passage refers to the impossibility of using Hitler's services even in the event of probable war with the Soviets. These papers originated in late 1948, just after the Soviet coup in Czechoslovakia and their military blockade of Berlin, when there was a firm, official belief that war with Russia was only a matter of time. I would interrupt in Radio Free America 37. We took a look at the role of the Galen Organization in specifically generating misinformation or disinformation that would incline American authorities in that direction, which it did. Continuing. The discovery and disclosure of these counterintelligence corps documents caused considerable official concern in 1987 when an American investigative reporter resident in England, Mrs. Dawn Honeyman, H-O-N-E-Y-M-A-N, who writes under the name of Gita Sereny, S-E-R-E-N-Y, wished to publish them in the London Sunday Times and sought official verification in the United States. Honeyman Sereny contacted Robert Wolf at the National Archives in Washington. Wolf, who has a well-deserved reputation as one of the best-informed experts on German documents, at once contacted the authorities at Fort George Meade in Maryland, repository of the archives of U.S. military intelligence units. I would also interject that's also the headquarters of the National Security Agency. Continuing. Wolf showed copies of these documents to Colonel Walsh, W-A-L-S-H, the director of the archive, who stated that while he could not find a declassification stamp on the papers, they looked authentic. Following this initial contact, Mr. Wolf was notified in writing by the Fort Meade personnel that they had no file on Heinrich Mueller at all. As Mueller was one of the top counterintelligence leaders in Germany during the war, this was a statement that was beyond belief. A subsequent check by an agency of the Justice Department revealed that there was a file on Mueller, but that it was small, only 40 pages, and unimportant. Next, the documents were checked by the FBI's forensic lab, and a search was made for other reports from the Berlin CIC office to see if the authors of the disputed papers existed at the time frame in question. It was confirmed that the signatories of the papers were in Berlin at the time, that the signatures on authentic papers and official files were correct, that the typewriters
and typed faces were correct to the period, and the CIC agents' writing styles matched those of the newly discovered reports. Further, Honeyman Sereny located and interviewed a former counterintelligence corps officer who had worked in the Berlin office and knew the agents whose signatures appeared in the documents. He stated that the style, format, and methodology was correct and met the tone and breadth of the personalities of the individuals involved. Mr. Wolf stated that in his opinion, based on all the internal evidence, the documents were authentic. He was unable to locate them in any official file and could not expand his statement any further. Mueller's personal papers go into far more detail about the last week in Berlin and spell out in accurate form the actual mechanics of the escape from his personal observations. The questions asked Mueller by U.S. agents are very clear, and Mueller's answers are equally clear and unambiguous. These statements make it very evident that Mueller was one of the very few persons whom Hitler trusted fully. In point of fact, Hitler literally placed his life in Mueller's hands. The chief of the Gestapo orchestrated the entire operation and remained in Berlin after the escape to guarantee its success. And again, it is upon these documents, the veracity of which was discussed in the passage I just read, that the article I'm reading to you is based. Skipping down, of the reason for Heinrich Mueller's eventual employment by U.S. intelligence, well, obviously he was head of the Gestapo and as such had a considerable track record of working against communist agents and the communist party cells in the various territories occupied by Nazi Germany. Of Mueller's anti-communist expertise, the raison d'etre for his eventual employment by U.S. intelligence, Gregory Douglas writes as follows. The one hallmark of Heinrich Mueller's reign at Gestapo headquarters on Prinz Albrechtstrasse in Berlin was his savage and brilliantly successful campaign against Soviet espionage and the German traitors who had infiltrated into all walks of German life. Although the Army's Abwehr first uncovered the Red Orchestra network, Mueller's Gestapo took control of the investigation and effectively broke the back of Stalin's efficient and well-entrenched apparatus. One of Mueller's specialties was the turning of enemy agents, persuading them to work for him against their former masters, and he succeeded in penetrating into the very top levels of the Soviet intelligence high command. He uncovered agents operating at the highest levels in England and the United States, information which was of vital post-war interest to American counterintelligence. Skipping down. When queried after the fact by his American employers as to why he might have helped Hitler escape, note this first sentence because it's a doozy. When queried after the fact by his American employers as to why he might have helped Hitler escape, he acknowledged his signature on various documents relating to the flight but refused to assist in locating the absent Führer. Mueller said in his blunt and dismissive manner that he had given his word on certain matters and had no intention of violating it. There was nothing substantive to be gained from Mueller on the subject of Hitler's fate. Quote, "It is not that I cannot tell you about this, but rest assured that I will not tell you, and put that matter right out of your heads this moment," unquote, was his curt reply to repeated requests for more information. He did, however, explain in great detail the mechanics of Hitler's departure without mentioning anything concerning Hitler's eventual fate. He also added an absorbing and dramatic account of his own flight to freedom in Switzerland on April 29th, 1945. Mueller's account of Hitler's final weeks in Berlin is at variance with the British and Soviet theories, but unlike these, was not crafted for propaganda purposes. Mueller was not under arrest or under interrogation when he covered this episode. He was being interviewed with an eye to employing his services, and his questioner made it very clear that the main reason for the long sessions was to avoid any possible problems emerging at a future time. Mueller's employment was a foregone conclusion, but his employers were not interested in surprises. And again, his employers, U.S. intelligence. That, again, taken from Miscellaneous Archive Show M57, titled The Flight of the Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler, recorded on October 31st of 1993. And in turn, that excerpt was from the article The Flight of the Wolf, Berlin 1945, from the Military Advisor, the publication for international military hobbyists and historians. The article was authored by Gregory Douglas, and it was from the Military Historian, Volume 4, Number 1,
from the winter of 1992 and 1993. Now note the sourcing for the information about Heinrich Mueller's escape and his work for U.S. intelligence, especially U.S. military intelligence documents, including and especially counterintelligence corps documents, and those accessed in turn from Fort Meade and the U.S. National National Archives. Compare the information from M57 with the following from the Los Angeles Times of Monday, February 26th of the year 2001. This is an article by Henry Weinstein titled, "New Questions Arise on Fate of Gestapo Chief." It reads in part as follows. For more than 50 years, Nazi hunters and historians have tried in vain to discover what happened to Gestapo chieftain Heinrich Mueller, who vanished in 1945 at the end of World War II. Of all the major Nazis, Mueller, who was Adolf Eichmann's immediate superior, is the most important still unaccounted for, according to numerous Holocaust experts. Now, efforts to solve the mystery are resurfacing, including attempts to answer the most provocative question of all: was Mueller briefly in U.S. custody after the war? If so, did he escape, or was he freed to become a CIA spy? Mueller is officially registered as dead in Berlin, but his grave turned out to contain two unknown soldiers when it was opened more than 30 years ago. His children subsequently removed the headstone from the burial plot. Listen to the following. U.S. Army intelligence records indicate that Mueller, who was nicknamed Gestapo Mueller to distinguish him from the hundreds of other Mueller's in the Nazi hierarchy, was captured by Americans in 1945, says historian George Chalou, C-H-A-L-O-U, who worked at the National Archives for 28 years. But what happened after that is the $64 question, unquote, he said, skipping down. In about a month, the National Archives plans to release a 500-page Central Intelligence Agency file on Mueller, which may shed further light on his post-war activities, according to Greg Bradsher, an historian at the Archives. So far, the bulk of publicly available material on Mueller comes from U.S. Army intelligence files and material gathered by historians. Last week, a German television network aired a program based in part on documents from the U.S. National Archives in Maryland, claiming that Mueller was captured by the U.S. Army, but released for unknown reasons. The program speculated that Mueller may have been employed by a U.S. intelligence agency, but offered no substantiation for that assertion. Skipping down again, speaking of the Mueller files, the files contain tantalizing material, including many items that contradict one another. Despite the fact that the files were opened more than 50 years after the end of World War II, numerous portions have been redacted. In February of 1999, 8 months before the Army records were made public by the National Archives, Army officials sent Rabbi Heyer, that's of the Wiesenthal Institute, a letter saying some of his requests for information on Mueller were being denied on grounds of national security, unquote, including the possibility that more complete disclosure could compromise intelligence-gathering methods. And, skipping down again, index cards stating that Mueller was in custody first in the town of Ilmenau and then in December of 1945 in a civilian internment camp in Altenstadt in Upper Bavaria. The card does not state what happened to Mueller at Altenstadt. It ends with the cryptic and provocative sentence, "Case closed, 29th of January, 46," unquote. It is unclear who placed the information on the card which states that a Mueller dossier was to be sent to Frankfurt. And another item from the Mueller file. There have been unconfirmed reports that he served as an enforcer for former Nazis living in South America. That is a somewhat oblique reference to what has been established about Heinrich Mueller, which is not only that he escaped, but that he also did work for U.S. intelligence, but even more importantly, he wasn't really so much working for U.S. intelligence as occasionally with them. He was, however, working as the security director for the remarkable and deadly Bormann Flight Capital Organization, about which I've spoken so many times, the economic and political component of a Third Reich gone underground. The definitive book about the Bormann Organization is one that I've used many times on this program. It's called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, authored by Edward R. Murrow colleague Paul Manning, published in hardcover by Lyle Stewart, copyright 1981, And we're going to take a look at two excerpts. First of all, from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, detailing Heinrich Mueller's work and the organization's work with U.S. intelligence and related elements. First, the following from Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. The Bormann Organization had many commercial and political links to the capitals of these three nations, that being the Federal Republic of Germany, the United States, and Britain. Beginning again, the Bormann Organization had many commercial and political links to the capitals of these three nations, and real clout was available should the chase become too hot. The CIA could have pulled aside the gray curtain that obscured Bormann at any time. But the CIA and Mueller's crack organization of former SS men have found it to their mutual advantage to cooperate in many situations. There is no morality in the sense that most of us know it in the strange world of professional secrecy, and when it was to the advantage of each to work together, they did so. And also, Reinhard Gehlen, first the intelligence chief for the Eastern Front in World War II for the Third Reich, later head of that same organization when it worked for U.S. intelligence, and ultimately the chief of that same organization when it, for all intents and purposes, when it evolved into the West German Intelligence Service, the BND, and not surprisingly, the Gehlen Org, too, worked with the Mueller organization. Turning once again to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, even General Gehlen, when he was chief of the Federal Republic's intelligence service, sent his agents to confer with General Heinrich Mueller in South America. And more about the Bormann Organization and Mueller's work as its security director, and of Paul Manning's direct interface with the Bormann Org and the Mueller security outfit. West Germany's economic power structure is fueled by a two-tier system. The corporations and individuals who publicly represent the products that are common household names around the world, and the secretive groups operating in the background as holding companies and who pulled the threads of power in overseas corporations established during the Bormann tenure in the Third Reich. As explained to me, quote, these threads are like the strands of a spider's web, and no one knows where they lead except the inner circle of the Bormann organization in South America, unquote. Skipping down, during years of research for this book, I have become aware of Heinrich Mueller and his security force, which provides protection for the leadership in Latin America and wherever else they may travel to Europe and to the United States to check on investments and profits. Through intermediaries, I have attempted unceasingly to penetrate to the central core of the organization in South America, but have been denied access. At the last meeting that I know about, it was voted, quote, Herr Manning's writing would focus undue attention on our activities, and his request must once again be denied, unquote. The elderly leaders, including Reichsminister Bormann, who was now 80, wanted me on the scene to write of their side of the story, above all his story, of one of the most amazing and successful financial and industrial cloaking actions in history, of which he is justifiably proud. I had sent word to Bormann that the true story, his first-hand account, should become a matter of historical record, and stated that I would be agreeable to writing it if I could tell his true story, warts and all. Back came the word, quote, you are a free world journalist and can write as you think best. We, too, are interested only in truth, unquote. They agreed to my request to bring along a three-man camera crew from CBS News to film my conversations with Martin Bormann, and even approved my wish for at least a personal thumbprint of the former Reichsleiter and party minister, which would be positive proof of his identity. At the organization's request, I sent the background, names, photos, and credentials of the particular CBS cameramen. Lawrence Walter Pierce, Richard Henry Perez, and Odin Lester Kitzmiller, an award-winning camera crew which got the exclusive film coverage of the attempted assassination of Governor George Wallace when he was running for president. I am sorry to say that the younger leaders, the ones now in virtual command, voted no. They did agree, however, that 232 historical documents from World War II, which Bormann had shipped out of Berlin in the waning days of the war, and which are now stored in his archives in South America, could be sent to me anonymously to be published. They said their lengthy investigation of me had produced confidence that I was an objective journalist as well as a brave one, for their probing stretched back to World War II days and up to the present. Heinrich Mueller, now 79 years old, who also serves as keeper of these archives as well as chief of all security for the NSDAP, rejected this decision. When the courier reached the Buenos Aires International Airport bearing these documents for me, he was relieved of them by the Argentine secret police, acting under an initiative from Mueller. As Mueller had explained previously, he had nothing against me personally. I had been cleared of any strange connections, unquote, by his agents in New York City, whose surveillance efforts were supplemented by the old pros of the Gestapo up from South America to assist in watching me. This continued intermittently for years, and efforts were stepped up in response to the intensity of my investigations. The statement I had originally made to their representatives in West Germany, that I was only a diligent journalist trying to dig out an important story, finally proved satisfactory to them. I observed that Mueller hadn't lost his touch in the field of surveillance, judging by the quality, skill, and number of men and women who tracked me at what must have been enormous cost wherever I went in New York City, Washington, and overseas. In rejecting my request for a meeting with Bormann, and in intercepting the documents, Mueller sent word that other factors outweighed any consideration for me. The KGB, the CIA, and President Stroessner of Paraguay, quote, "who just does not like inquiring reporters," unquote. And still more about the Mueller work as on behalf of the Bormann organization, Mueller being the security director, returning once again to Manning's Martin Bormann Nazi in Exile. As security chief for the Nazi organization in South America and Europe, General Mueller keeps a close eye on the leadership and on those he feels might threaten them. Israeli agents who move too closely to these centers of power are eliminated. One such termination was Fritz Bauer, former attorney general for the state of Hesse in Frankfurt, a survivor of Auschwitz, and the man who tipped off the Israeli Mossad about the presence of Adolf Eichmann in Buenos Aires. Bauer was killed on orders of General Mueller. His body was found in his bathtub and listed as death by heart attack, unquote, by the Frankfurt police. The real cause? Cyanide spray that induces heart stoppage without detection. The same modus operandi that Mueller used to kill the Bormann stand-ins who were placed in the Berlin freight yards in late April of 1945. Mueller's ruthlessness even today is what deters Arthur Oxmann from altering his testimony that he saw Bormann lying dead on the roadway the night of their escape from the Führer bunker, May 1st and 2nd, 1945. This story had been composed by Mueller. To this day, Oxmann, the only so-called living witness to the death, unquote, of Bormann in Berlin, knows his life is in jeopardy if he reverses himself. General Mueller is thorough and has a long memory, and for a Nazi such as Oxmann to go against Mueller's original directive would make him a traitor. Retribution would surely follow. When I questioned one SS man who had once worked closely with Bormann in South America about the Oxmann testimony, he said, quote, "Oxmann knows Bormann is in South America. I don't know why he persists in lying about the fact," unquote. He thought a moment and then went on, "but perhaps he wants to go on living, which is reason enough," unquote. What we're going to do next is to listen to an excerpt from For the Record program number 145 about Mueller's security efforts on behalf of the Bormann organization in discrediting investigator Ladislaus Farrago. You will also hear about Paul Manning's sourcing for this book. The following is excerpted from a letter from Paul Manning to Mr. William Leonard, the president of CBS News, on November 1st of 1981. Last week on AM Chicago, I appeared for 30 minutes with Simon Wiesenthal's number one Nazi hunter, who acknowledged on the air with me that Bormann had surely made it out of Berlin to South America, and also agreed that the gray eminence of clandestine affairs was, and is, General Mueller of the Gestapo, who today, at 79, is security chief for the Bormann organization, and whose title at present translated is, quote, "Minister of the Interior in Exile for the organization," unquote. By the way, General Mueller, according to information that I presented in a miscellaneous archive show entitled Flight of the Wolf, worked for U.S. intelligence after World War II. He also arranged for the escape of Adolf Hitler. That'll appear crazy, but the documentation appears quite sound and was done by a London Times journalist, completely blacked out in the United States. Continuing. I last saw Heinrich Mueller in Tripoli, where I was tracing the Nazi connection. Mueller was having dinner in the Normandy Hotel with his staff, having been retained for $5 million by Colonel Muammar el-Qaddafi to set up a new intelligence service following the overthrow of King Idris in 1970. Since that time, every Libyan embassy and consulate in the world has security and intelligence provided by the men trained in those years by General Mueller. It was Mueller who discredited Ladislaus Farrago back in 1973. The KGB is expert at disinformation, but Mueller and his group are far better at it. When I was in West Germany, talking with some SS veterans, separately, as always, of the Bormann organization,
I was told that Farrago was in South America tracking the Bormann story. The particular man who had provided a safe house for Bormann in the 10 days after the Reichsleiter had escaped from the Führer bunker said to me, quote, "But that is okay. General Mueller has plans for Farrago. He is not going to have him killed. He will be discredited in the world press. Wait and see," unquote. One of Mueller's agents started supplying Farrago with forged documents, then with a snapshot purporting to be of Bormann and an Argentine secret agent at the border of Chile. When it had been displayed in newspapers around the world, Mueller next had his agent go to the New York Times bureau chief in Buenos Aires and, quote, reveal, unquote, that the snapshot was of a high school teacher and a companion of his, the picture having been artfully posed against a recognizable school building. This disclosure and the false documents that Farrago had trustingly taken did him in. The effect on journalism and on editors in general was more devastating than that on Farrago himself. The search for the truth in this matter faltered, and the notion that Bormann had been long dead continued to be fostered by Willy Brandt, the CIA, and successive West German governments. I have been told that Mueller once explained, quote, "The world is a chessboard, and editors are my pawns," unquote. Mueller has been finessing the news media everywhere for 36 years. By the way, in this country, the attack on Ladislaus Farrago's credibility was led by Gerald Posner, who in recent years has endorsed the untenable theses that both James Earl Ray and Lee Harvey Oswald were the lone nut assassins of Martin Luther King and President Kennedy, respectively. Both of those contentions roundly and credibly disproved, despite Posner's advocacy of same. Continuing with this letter from Paul Manning to William Leonard, the president of CBS News from November 1, 1981. "Consequently, I have been extremely careful in my research. My sources include the U.S. Treasury Department, the Office of Strategic Services, or OSS, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, especially J. Edgar Hoover's files relating to Bormann and Nazis in South America, Deutsche Bank of Buenos Aires, the Argentina Secret Police Central files, the National Archives in Washington, D.C., Captured Enemy Documents section, as well as conversations with more than 200 Germans and other Europeans who one way or another were on the scene, down through all sorts of Secret Service organizations, including MI6 in Britain and the Secret Intelligence Service of Britain's Foreign Ministry. An officer of the Galen Intelligence Group made his contribution, as did some in the Israeli Mossad, who know perfectly well that Bormann is in South America and so have never closed their file on him. As stated in my acknowledgement, Alan Dulles checked out my notes and said I was on the right track and should keep going. On that Chicago television program, the Wiesenthal spokesman and I discussed the relative ratings of the world intelligence organizations. He put the Mueller people at the top of the list. I placed the Mossad second and ahead of every other spy organization except that of Mueller, which I certainly agree is undeniably tops." That, again, excerpted from For the Record program number 145, the correspondence of Paul Manning, that in turn taken from a letter by Paul Manning to Mr. William Leonard, the president of CBS News, on November 1st of 1981. Note again the documentation from the excerpt from M57 about Mueller's escape, his survival, and his work for U.S. intelligence. Note the sourcing there, and also note that the sourcing on the L.A. Times article from 2/26/2001 overlaps that considerably. Why do you suppose those documents were redacted? That concludes For the Record program number 283, The Mueller File. This is being recorded on March 18th of the year 2001. You can see a detailed and annotated description of For the Record program number 283 on the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. The For the Record segments are now being archived by sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey. You can listen to those real audio archives at wfmu.org/Dave Emery. That concludes For the Record number 283. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.